Welcome to this new detailed edition of the BayPay Forum Blockchain News. My name is Cindy and today is September 18, 2020. This edition is brought to you by PayCademy, the first business academy to learn payments and fintech. If you have some news in payments and fintech, send it to us at press@baypayforum.com and we will do our best to include your news. In this edition, we will talk about Survey: almost half of crypto traders are long-term investors. Despite YETH returns of 2%, Yearn pushes forward with WBTC Vault. MicroStrategy CEO says Bitcoin scales just fine as store of value. Bitcoin whale clusters show $9,800 support is now weaker despite rally. This DeFi group wants to bring maturity to the yield farming craze. How U.S. states are, and aren't, easing crypto firms' compliance burden. Now let's get started. Survey: almost half of crypto traders are long-term investors. Which asset is the most popular long-term investment? The answer may not surprise you. According to a recent survey of Huobi traders, 45% of respondents have time horizons longer than 1 year, with 12.5% saying that they are willing to wait over 4 years for a return on their investment. This seems to contradict the widely accepted view that most crypto investors are just there to make a quick buck. When asked which asset they have held the longest, it's no surprise that 69% said it was Bitcoin (BTC). Despite the vast majority of respondents belonging to the 26 to 50 age range, most of the respondents have less than 3 years of investment experience. Also, more than half of the surveyed individuals have an annual income of $10,000 or below. Though this may seem low, we should note the survey took place in the emerging markets according to Huobi, where this level of income may not necessarily be considered low. Another important consideration is that only 491 individuals responded to the survey, thus it is unclear how representative this sampling is. It appears there is a shift taking place in the way cryptocurrency is being perceived by both retail and professional investors from a get-rich-quick scheme to a more long-term game. Despite YETH returns of 2%, Yearn pushes forward with WBTC Vault. Yearn Finance has submitted a maker improvement proposal for its forthcoming WBTC Vault, suggesting it will launch in the not-too-distant future. The popular yield-farming decentralized finance DeFi protocol Yearn Finance is progressing with its forthcoming wrapped Bitcoin, WBTC, Vault. The team has submitted a Maker DAO improvement proposal requesting whitelisting for the WBTC Vault to access upcoming Oracle pricing from Maker, suggesting its launch may not be too far off. Vaults are Yearn Finance's core product. They use smart contracts to mobilize pooled assets from users to pursue arbitrage and yield farming strategies while sharing fees to mitigate gas costs. As with Yearn's recently launched wrapped Ethereum (WETH) Vault, the WBTC Vault will leverage DAI minted against user holdings, which are then delegated to the protocol's DAI Vault and mobilized to generate yield. While Yearn's Ether Vault saw deposits suspended after roughly $70 million worth ETH was delegated within days of its launch in early September, the returns generated by Yearn's vaults have fallen sharply in recent days. 2 weeks ago, Yearn's ETH Vault was producing a weekly annualized percentage yield, APY, of more than 50%, while the DAI Vault offered 80% APY. As of this writing, the DAI Vault is generating a weekly APY of 30%. While the returns offered by the ETH Vault have plummeted 95% to post a weekly return equivalent to just 2% a year. On September 18, Yearn Finance introduced its new synthetic rebase dollar, comprising a credit-based rebase index. The index is intended to track the value of underlying assets against which a stablecoin has been minted, and automatically increases or decreases the sum of outstanding minted stablecoins in response to price fluctuations. The team stated that they are not yet sure what they will use the protocol for, and wanted to publish the index so that others can build with and advance the technology. MicroStrategy CEO says Bitcoin scales just fine as store of value. Arguably the biggest Bitcoin adoption move of 2020 turned 78,338 off-chain transactions into just 18 on-chain ones, with MicroStrategy praising scalability. Bitcoin BTC as a store of value scales just fine. The CEO of the company that just purchased 38,250 BTC has said. In a tweet on September 17, Michael Saylor revealed more information about MicroStrategy's dramatic launch into Bitcoin. Saylor praises Bitcoin as a scalable store of value. Continually making the headlines since its first buy in August, MicroStrategy has now swapped over $400 million of spare capital from USD to BTC. An interview between Saylor and Morgan Creek Digital co-founder, Anthony Pompliano this week underscored his commitment, having previously been highly skeptical of Bitcoin. Now, his belief in the technical fundamentals of the network and its future is certain. The problem of scaling to meet demand, for example, is a non-issue for Saylor thanks to off-chain transactions. MicroStrategy's initial buy in 21,454 BTC for $250 million was a case in point. We acquired 21,454 BTC via 78,388 off-chain transactions, then secured it in cold storage with 18 on-chain transactions, he wrote. Hashtag Bitcoin scales just fine as a store of value. Woo, 2021 may be the year of MicroStrategy Bitcoin trailblazers. Continuing, Saylor described a status quo where on-chain transactions for major investors will remain a rarity. If hashtag Bitcoin is treated as a treasury reserve asset, based on our model, 99.98% of all transactions will be off-chain, and assets at risk will be in cold storage 99.92% of the time. Off-chain transactions via solutions such as the Lightning Network allow Bitcoin transaction volume to increase without adding volume to the blockchain and raising fees to appeal to miners. In his popular book, The Bitcoin Standard, Saif Dean Amis likewise argues that off-chain activity will become the norm once Bitcoin gains a much larger user base. That could happen sooner rather than later. Following the Pompliano interview, statistician Willie Wu picked up on Saylor highlighting the world's 35,000 publicly traded companies that have spare cash reserves of $5 trillion. I make out if others follow MicroStrategy's lead and even just 1% of that capital finds its way into BTC, that's enough to blow Bitcoin cap to $2 trillion, he tweeted. Wu added that given MicroStrategy took 6 months to approve its shift to Bitcoin, any copycat moves would begin to surface in 2021. Bitcoin whale clusters show $9,800 support is now weaker despite rally. Bitcoin whale clusters at $9,800 have grown in size in the past few days, indicating some whales may be preparing to sell. According to data from WhaleMap, an on-chain analysis firm that tracks Bitcoin BTC whales, the $9,800 support has weakened. The researchers at WhaleMap track whale activities by following addresses owned by whales' individual investors that own large sums of BTC. They explained, some hodler activity yesterday. Bubbles show where these hodler coins were coming from. The biggest bubbles come from the pre-corona area at 9,800. To me, this means our support at 9,800 just got a little weaker. Several whale clusters at $9,800 have become larger in the past several days. The data suggests that whales who bought at $9,800 are moving their BTC to exchanges. Bad news if Bitcoin drops below $10,000. Since the data shows that some whales who bought at $9,800 might be preparing to sell, an argument could be made that the support has weakened. But whether the weakening support would mean BTC would drop below $9,800 is a different scenario. The $9,800 level is weaker than before, but that does not necessarily mean that BTC would drop below it as a result. A short-term bearish scenario could play out if other whales push BTC down to the $9,800 support level. Only then, the weak support could amplify the downturn of BTC in the near term. If Bitcoin does not drop to sub $10,000 in the immediate future, then the support level itself becomes less relevant. Red bubbles on the whale maps charts grow when whales move their funds out of their wallets. The researchers explained. Red bubbles show locations at which the hodlers originally held their BTC before transacting it. So imagine you bought bitcoins at the $20,000 peak and yesterday you decided to send them to an exchange, for instance. In this scenario, red bubble at 2017 peak will appear. In the short term, a bearish case for BTC is that whales who bought at $9,800 sell above $11,000, bringing the price down to sub $10,000 for a pullback. On August 23, Cointelegraph reported whales who bought Bitcoin in late 2018 sold 2 years after holding onto their BTC. Since then, the BTC price fell sharply from $12,500 to as low as $9,800 across major exchanges. Similar to late August, Bitcoin is at a heavy high time frame resistance at $11,100. A sell-off from whales at the current level could trigger a sizable pullback and a strong market reaction. A highly anticipated CME gap also exists at $9,600, and the rejection of $11,100 could lead institutions to try to close that gap. What do traders think? For now, the sentiment around Bitcoin remains overwhelmingly positive. Bitcoin has remained above $10,700 following its recent minor rejection from $11,100. Michael van de Papa, a full-time trader at the Amsterdam Stock Exchange, said the chances of an $11,100 retest is higher. He said, "The $10,750 area held and we're targeting the range high here again. Crucial breaker for bullish continuation is $11,100 minus $11,300. If that breaks, we'll head towards $12,000. This DeFi group wants to bring maturity to the yield farming craze. The Chicago DeFi Alliance, launched in April, is poised to help members make a killing from the recent decentralized finance, DeFi, craze. So many billions of dollars worth of assets are now cycling through various DeFi projects at such erratic rates that while you're reading this, the estimates are probably changing. Suffice it to say, the Chicago DeFi Alliance now has roughly 55 members, including new additions Binance, US and MakerDAO. After graduating 7 DeFi startups from its first accelerator program this summer, CDA partner Chao Wang said the organization is now launching a liquidity launchpad program to get informed and professional players in this space committing their crypto to various protocols. First, the program vets pre-seed DeFi startups, unlike the accelerator program for slightly more mature startups, with a standardized process that involves audits and traditional measures of professionalism, such as being a registered company. Some of the food-themed DeFi projects garnering attention today are rough drafts without audits or formal teams. Then, the CDA does matchmaking of experienced investors, market makers and DeFi builders. Teller Finance, the startup behind a credit and loan management protocol, is the first startup to kick off the Launchpad program. The teams are validated and the smart contracts are audited. These are long-term, sustainable projects, CDA and Volt Capital co-founder Imran Khan said during a Google Hangouts interview. This allows institutional investors to provide liquidity for a fixed amount of time. We hope to have market makers that are there for the long term, not just the short term. To that end, Teller Finance co-founder Ryan Birkin said the CDA Launchpad provided his startup with $10 million worth of liquidity to kickstart Teller's lending program. CDA's backers and traders provide liquidity, continual market making, for a DeFi platform. This gives other users the ability to move money around without steep costs or hassle, letting them dabble in the yield farming of niche tokens that can be played for potential gain. In Teller's case, providing a loan creates Teller reward tokens that can be used for voting. We're starting with governance of your own money, on-chain variables that relate to how money moves and the data gets assessed, Birkin said. We're rolling out progressive decentralization in ways that are similar to Uniswap. Users who aren't financial experts or math students can delegate their voting tokens to an external expert to vote on their behalf for favorable lending terms. Much like the DeFi protocol Compound, the Teller protocol offers a mostly non-custodial way to use assets like Ether, ETH, as collateral for loans in stablecoins like DAI or USDC. But Teller is arguably taking a much more involved approach to risk management. So far, Khan said, the retail-driven DeFi experiments have been unnecessarily risky and volatile. The launchpad offers institutional investors and traders a way to capitalize on the liquidity mining craze, focusing on these vetted projects. Teller is taking a more heavy-handed approach to credit risk by using the Visa-owned service provider Plaid to assess users' banking records. Plus, Teller Finance already raised a $1 million venture round since its founding in early 2020, according to the team. We're using the Visa system to securely transmute banking data to the protocol, that helps with making sure the data stays private, said Teller Finance Communications lead Ben Noble. If you want to get your credit assessment, you submit your information and the Teller nodes come back with an open source credit assessment, Birkin said, adding the startup plans to launch the network in October with a small group of permissioned nodes. These loans can be undercollateralized or even uncollateralized, so the option of a real credit assessment helps manage or prevent undue risk. More diverse access to yield farming and different assets will be rolled out slowly, the Teller team said. There will be a token sale in the near future, they added, but they want to get enough tokens in circulating supply before we pull the trigger on that, Noble said. That's what the CDA provides, a regulation-centric roadmap toward healthy circulation. DeFi matchmaking. While startups gain access and capital from the launchpad, they aren't subject to the whims of investors the way they might be in a venture capital raise. CDA backers are expecting to make their own profits using the system, rather than rely on equity for returns. At the same time, launchpad startups can choose to keep their experiments open to the public and only place lockup periods on institutional players. If the institutional backers believe the DeFi startup will be profitable and sustainable, they might accept biased trading terms and as a longer play. Institutional investors have an inherent advantage anyway, since arbitrage strategies benefit from scale. Sometimes, you have under-the-radar products that don't know how to do marketing. They don't know how to market to retail users or providers. Those retail users are very hype-driven, Wang said, explaining why social media buzz might highlight the silly DeFi experiments rather than the promising fintech startups. He hopes this launchpad program will counteract that dynamic. While it's too soon to say what impact CDA will have on broader DeFi trends, the accelerator program just accepted a new batch of participants and alumni reportedly feel satisfied with the experience. Ming Ng, advisor to the alumni startup Kyber Network, said the imminent Kyber Pro framework for professional market makers would not be possible without the collaboration with CDA. Imran and Chow have also been super helpful in matching needs and expertise within the groups, Ng added. Perhaps a more mature form of yield farming will emerge from the combination of the launchpad and the second accelerator cohort. After reviewing more than 100 applications, Khan said, the CDA announced its fall cohort, Pods, Paraswap, Saddle, Notional, Tokenlin, Vega, Derivadex, Perp, Loopring, Diversify, McDex and Akala. Teller's Birkin said his startup will collaborate with numerous CDA accelerator participants, offering a vetted whitelist where users can deploy their new crypto loans. The whitelist provides guardrails as people learn and get used to the system, added Noble. How U.S. states are, and aren't, easing crypto firms' compliance burden. The Conference of State Bank Supervisors, CSBS, an organization of state financial regulators, will make it easier for financial technology payment firms and cryptocurrency exchanges to prove they're in compliance with U.S. state laws. The CSBS announced a one-company, One exam plan Tuesday whereby states will coordinate their supervisory exams for the nation's largest payment firms in an effort to reduce the costs on both state regulators and the companies they oversee. Essentially, the exam is how these regulators will make sure regulated entities are still in compliance. What this means for cryptocurrency companies such as Coinbase is their compliance costs will drop. Rather than work with more than 50 different state and territory regulators, the exchanges only need to check in with the one group. The group of regulators includes every state but Montana, which doesn't have a money transmission license. Crypto exchanges need money transmission licenses to legally operate within most states, with the state banking or financial services regulator overseeing this form of regulated activity. For the industry, that means there's going to be a reduction in regulatory burden, said Matt Lambert, non-bank counsel for CSBS. However, new exchanges will still have to apply for, and secure, a license for each state in which they hope to operate. While the CSBS is working on a potential standard for applications, there's still a long way to go. At present, the move also only applies to the 78 largest money transmitters in the U.S., those operating in at least 40 states. While Lambert declined to identify which crypto businesses fit into this category, a search of the nationwide multi-state licensing system and registry database indicates this could include Coinbase, Circle Internet Financial, and Square. The list of firms that will benefit from CSBS announcement could still grow. While there aren't any plans right now to add to the list of companies, Lambert said more could be added later on. Strictest standards. The CSBS announced its effort to consolidate supervision at least partly as a result of soliciting feedback from the crypto industry, and finding that regulated entities believed there is too much supervision that is accomplishing the same thing, Lambert said. Overall, I think this process will lead to high standards, the strictest standards, he said. This is not going to be a means of defaulting to the lowest standards, this is going to be a method of raising the bar for everyone. Each exam will be conducted by a group of state regulators, and the makeup of the group will change on an exam-by-exam basis. This lets the regulators coordinate among themselves to find the best fit for each company's evaluation. One state will lead the other group members in administering each exam. Daniel Gorfein, the former fintech innovation lead at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission and a director with the Digital Dollar Project, told CoinDesk the move helps in the development of regulations around fintech. This approach would be similar to the dual banking system, which recognizes state and federally chartered banks and has been effective in safely promoting competition, innovation and choice both for consumers as well as industry, he said. Linda Lacewell, superintendent of the New York Department of Financial Services, echoed his view, saying on Twitter a dual banking system is needed as states better understand their local ecosystems. Lowered costs by coordinating, the states are able to save their own resources. Lambert said the different states will be able to reduce their supervisory costs because they won't have to conduct every exam. If you only have one exam nationwide, you can make sure the best examiners are at that exam and can leverage the resources of the states, he said. Lacewell said on Twitter the move would also reduce burdens on the industry. Regulated companies will also find their own bills reduced, said Brian Nistler, an attorney with Lowenstein Sandler. He told CoinDesk the first effect is an overdue reduction in compliance costs and regulatory redundancies for money service businesses and the state regulators. This is especially important because costs for the crypto industry have ballooned over the last few years, he said. As a result, entities have been asking for the exams to be streamlined for some time now. Circle CEO Jeremy Allaire agreed, saying in a statement the move would streamline his company's efforts to work with state banking regulators. He said the new framework indicates very significant progress for crypto and fintech firms. It ensures that there is a consistent and well-run process for examining firms and ensuring that they can meet their regulatory obligations, he said. National framework. What Tuesday's announcement does not do is create a national framework for crypto companies. However, it is the latest move in a years-long effort to more closely coordinate between the states, Lambert said. The states have been working together in the supervision of money transmitters for a long time. Originally it was through the Money Transmitter Regulators Association and they continue to work through the states, he said. A possible next step may come through the creation of a multi-state licensing agreement. This project, which has also been in the works for some time, has about 29 states on board so far. It's unclear whether such an effort would negate the need for a federal charter, as acting controller of the currency Brian Brooks has suggested. As detailed, his proposed charter would allow fintech firms to bypass the state-by-state framework entirely. Nistler noted that when the states were writing their various money transmitter license regulations, no one thought the states would be responsible for regulating borderless online platforms, which was a view Gorfine shared. Kristen Smith, the executive director of the Blockchain Association, said a national framework or federal law is still needed. It makes little sense to have a patchwork of regulation and supervision, she said. Brooks congratulated CSBS for its announcement, but also indicated he agrees with the idea of a federal authority overseeing payment firms. While the efforts alleviate some of the inherent challenges facing a system based on 50 state laws and licensing regimes, only federal law and the uniform regulatory framework it provides fully addresses these issues, he said in a statement. This concludes our edition for today. We want to thank again Paycademy, the first business school to learn payments and fintech, for their support. You can find more information on their website at paycademy.com. We hope you enjoyed it and see you tomorrow for our next edition.